Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi joins us on Thursdays in the 12 o'clock hour, and we thank him for saying, because there's a lot to talk about, Rafi, almost every week. Something's going on. It's been crazy times.
Never a dull moment. Just like, the temperature outside, things always stay hot in criminal justice and public safety.
So, Rafi, let's start it this way. I know we want to talk about Khalil Bryan, but there's a breaking story by Joseph Craney on NOLA.com that outlines the release of another inmate, David A. Jones, back in December. And he was out of jail for 4 months before anyone realized that he was out. And now there's a difference of opinion between the sheriff, the DA, and the defendant's lawyer as to whether or not he was appropriately released. The DA says no, he was not appropriately released. And the defendant's lawyer says his client should have never been let out of jail. But the sheriff's office is maintaining that this was part of their process, and what they did was totally appropriate. I've never heard of something like this before. I mean, just...
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that case. A reporter contacted me about that just before I came on with you, and I told them that I didn't have time to look into it until I was finished with this. So, you know, what you're talking about is a symptom. And what we've seen from day one since the sheriff was sworn in is that a well-intentioned, intelligent woman that had no background really in corrections assumed that office. Now, she ran for that office as a progressive candidate. Quite frankly, I don't care if you're progressive or conservative, you need to be competent. And when she was elected to run that jail, her background was that she was the independent police monitor for the city of New Orleans. So during a large part of her tenure, the responsibility of the independent police monitor's daily chores was conducted by the federal consent decree monitor. So the independent police monitor basically had little to do, because most of the work that was being done with respect to making sure that the police department was operating constitutionally was being done under the direction of the federal consent decree and the independent federal monitor that was appointed to oversee the operations of the police department. So she walked out of an office of about, with a staff of 3 to 4 people, that most of their work was being done by a court-appointed federal monitor, into the sheriff's office. And, you know, it's one thing to not have relevant experience when you're elected to an office. That makes the people that you hire even more important. And the fundamental mistake that she made was that she hired people that had no background in corrections. That jail is, in my opinion, the toughest jail in the state of Louisiana to operate and to function in. Because you're looking at over 1,400 inmates that are in pretrial custody. Angola may have more people, and they may have more violent offenders, but the difference between the Department of Corrections and Angola and the Orleans Justice Center is the fact that those 1,400 inmates that are in the local jail are in there for pretrial offenses. They haven't been convicted. Everybody that's sent to Angola is going to be acclimated to the Department of Corrections by the inmates that are there. That'll be the culture setters that, you know, when the new inmates come in, they're going to be intermingling with the people that have been there for years or decades. So there's not an infusion of people that are fresh off the streets in the New Orleans jail. As I said, there are 1,430-some-odd people that are there this week. Over 200 of them are in there waiting to be tried on murder charges. Two-thirds of those are in there for felony crimes of violence or felony weapons offenses. And the other one-third that are in there for property and drug offenses remain in pretrial custody because they have extensive convictions for crimes of violence in their background. So you're looking at a totally different responsibility. And what we've seen since day one, since the sheriff was sworn into office, is a whole litany of embarrassments and mistakes that can only be attributed to, you know, poor management and poor decisions by her as the sheriff. So, you know, when we saw that mass escape, and, you know, the fact that it took her hours to alert the public of this mass escape, you know, that gave those offenders, you know, a 10-12 hour head start on trying to make themselves more difficult to locate. So what happened last Friday was another colossal failure. You know, when Khalil Bryant was, according to the sheriff, inadvertently released, you know, that is something that I've called for another investigation of by someone other than the sheriff's office. So what the sheriff's office did after they released Khalil Bryant, they were supposed to be releasing a 20-year-old, 5'6", 160-pound pretrial defendant that was in custody for theft of a firearm. Khalil Bryant, the person that was inadvertently released, is 6'4", 30 years old, and over 300 pounds. He has at least 10 open charges, not one charge. So a deputy had to go get Khalil Bryant off the pod that he was on at 1 o'clock in the morning. So they go get, supposed to be a different K. Bryant. I don't want to use the gentleman's name that was released because he's the victim of all of this. The 5'6", 160 pound, 20 year old, that was the person that was supposed to have been released. So the deputies knew the name, and they got the wrong person. Instead of the 5'6", 160-pound, 20-year-old, they got the 6'4", 300-pound, 30-year-old. So that was step one. Then they had to go bring him to get his property. So, again, the deputy that's in charge of the property, you know, is supposed to scan his wristband and identify him. And they give him the property belonging to a 5'6", 160-pound guy. So then they take him for processing out. And he's got to sign forms. So the deputy that got him off the pod, the deputy in the property room area, and the deputy in the processing area did not realize that they were processing out the wrong person. So one of the last steps that they do when they process out is run the inmate's finger. They're supposed to run their fingerprints through the system. That wasn't done. Or if it was done, the deputy didn't react to the information because it would have popped up the person's picture, and the fact that there was a hold from Jefferson Parish on him. So even if they were mistaken, they followed their protocols. It should have been caught. Three different steps. None of that occurred. So if you're talking about, you know, something that happened last December, all of that is a symptom. You know, the fact that those 10 inmates escaped and no one noticed that they were gone at the change of shift at 6 o'clock in the morning, they didn't alert the media and the public until around noon when they had escaped at about 12:30 in the morning. They had about a 12-hour head start, 11-hour head start on that. So all of these are symptoms of, you know, the sheriff that is maybe well-intentioned, but has proven to be, from a managerial standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, to be a disaster for the jail and the people of the city of New Orleans.
You know, it'd be interesting is what Khalil Bryan looked like when he was wearing the other K. Bryan's clothes when he walked out of the facility.
Well, I guarantee you, he couldn't have. You know,
how did he fit
into that clothing? You know, this is a massive guy. So Khalil Bryan wasn't arrested by the New Orleans Police Department. He was arrested by the Louisiana State Police. And, you know, they pulled the car over. He jumped out of the car and gave flight. They tracked him down and arrested him. So under the state law that went into effect in June, the sheriff has an obligation to alert law enforcement, victims, and the media when someone has left the premises of a facility without authority or escaped. The state police were never informed by the sheriff's office that this guy was no longer in custody. So I have requested that an investigation be determined, because when he was quote-unquote inadvertently released, the sheriff's office went to the judge in which he was being held on a prior prosecution and said, listen, we made a mistake. Would you issue a capias for his arrest? I believe that a crime was perpetrated by Khalil Bryan when he walked out of that jail, because you know, he knew he signed for property that belonged to the person that was supposed to be released. They have a different name. And if he signed receiving property that he knew wasn't his, you know, that's identity theft. That's potentially obstruction of justice. That's filing a false public record. And that is potentially, I believe, an escape. So if he failed to disclose or signed anything under the name of somebody else, that means that he's committed a crime. But the sheriff, for whatever reason, doesn't want to acknowledge that there was a crime perpetrated in the release of that suspect. And is it because that, you know, she doesn't want the stigma of yet another escape on her record when she's in the process of running for re-election? I don't know, but I think it needs to be investigated by someone other than the sheriff's office. So, you know, I've made that request. I don't know where that stands right now, but I think that there are a variety of criminal offenses that may have been committed by Khalil Bryant when he was, quote unquote, inadvertently released from custody last Friday.
And, I mean, the irony is the person who was the first to know that a mistake was made was the inmate.
I mean, it's like, well, he didn't even know. So his mother that posted bail. So
now I'm talking about the inmate that walked out, Khalil Bryan.
Yeah.
He was the first one to know that the mistake had been made.
Right.
when you want to talk about irony, you laugh to keep from crying here, right?
Yeah.
And no one else did.
So this is more than just a clerical mistake. You know, on the part of the deputies, you're not looking at one but multiple deputies that didn't follow protocols. And obviously, in the case that you're talking to me about now that I haven't had a chance to review, there are going to be other protocols that were potentially violated. And we know that, you know, after that mass escape, there were records that were presented to J.P. Morrell indicating that there were over 1,000 work orders open in the jail for maintenance and repairs. So when those 10 inmates escaped, you know, they escaped at 12:30 in the morning. And the escape didn't begin until there's supposed to be two deputies watching those inmates, one on the pod and one in the control booth. There was no deputy working on the pod that night. The inmates didn't try to escape until at 12:30, the deputy working in the control booth left his post to go eat. That's when the inmates exited their cells. Those cells are supposed to have been locked. The cells obviously weren't locked because 10 inmates came out of at least 5 cells. And we saw videotape of one of the inmates rocking the door to the cell that they escaped from and was able to open that just by tugging on it. The reason that their cells weren't locked and why they could open up the door to the cell that they escaped from was because they clogged the locking mechanism with toilet paper. The sheriff's office knew that those cells weren't operational, and they knew that they weren't locked. And the deputy that left his post to go eat set the escape process in play. And at the very least, when the deputy came back from dinner, he should have sent somebody into the pod just to make sure that everyone was still there. I don't know if the inmates that escaped bothered to close their cell doors behind them, but if the deputy comes back from dinner and the cell doors are open, you know, there's an indication that somebody needs to take a look and see what's going on, because those doors were closed when he left his post. All of that are symptoms of the sheriff's office failing to apply their internal rules and procedures and maintain the operations of the jail. If you don't have enough deputies, it makes maintaining the security mechanisms in the jail even more important, because you cannot compensate for the both the failure to maintain the proper security for the jail, coupled with the lack of manpower. So when you mix those two together, one has to compensate for the other. And the sheriff's protocols were not followed with respect to the escape of 10. It wasn't followed with respect to Khalil Bryan's release. And I suspect that, you know, this other case is bubbling to the surface now. There'll be others as well. And all of this is a reflection of the, you know, fundamental failure of the sheriff to manage and maintain what I consider to be the most challenging and problematic jail in the state of Louisiana.
No doubt. On the text line, gross incompetence isn't the only issue here. Institutional complacency. Well said. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Let us move on to a really interesting case. And the New Orleans District Attorney charged a real estate developer with racketeering and criminal blight. We've not seen this before, I don't believe, and so very interesting nonetheless.
Right. So this is a law that was passed in 2023, and you know from your years in law enforcement that, you know, when there are there are incubators for crime in every community, and it doesn't necessarily fix the problem just to arrest the offenders if the incubator exists. And nothing, so you take out one wave of offenders and somebody else moves into it. So that's exactly what was happening. And there was legislation passed in the state of Louisiana in 2023, making it a crime to have, you know, blighted property. Now, this isn't about holding people and, you know, arresting people for failing to paint their house or repair their roof or maintain their yard. There's some high thresholds for what the definition of blighted property is. And at the time that that law was passed, they also added that as a an offense in which the racketeering law in the state of Louisiana could be applied. So this is the first time in the history of the state of Louisiana since this law passed that, you know, someone has been charged with racketeering and criminally maintaining blighted property. And this case is an example of the high threshold that's involved. So District Attorney's Office indicted Edward Neil Morris for five counts, including racketeering, and four counts of blighted property. So this guy owned a bunch of property all over the city. And in the second district, primarily the Riverbend area, there were houses that were in commerce that he was using, in which there was criminal activity going on. And eventually those tenants were evicted. But after they were evicted and removed, Mr. Morris stopped maintaining the property. And those properties became magnets for other criminal activity. And he was noticed by the city to make repairs. Nothing came of that. He was actually fined and nothing came of it. And the Neighborhood Association, the Carrollton Riverbend Neighborhood Association, back in 2020, possibly a little bit earlier, began to receive complaints from their membership about these properties. They determined that they were owned by this property developer. So they attempted to contact Mr. Morris. They weren't successful. They continued to file complaints with the city agencies, and little or nothing was done. And then in 2023, they learned that some law had been passed, and it was suggested that they reach out to the district attorney's office to see if they might be able to help them with an issue that they have been struggling with for years. So the district attorney's office created a program called the No Dice Initiative, which what they've done since 2023 is nothing short of remarkable. So what No Dice does, and what the district attorney does, this is a non-traditional role for a prosecutor's office to do this. But if they didn't step into this void and do it, it wasn't being done. And there's been, you know, we've talked week after week, month after month, about some of the crime reductions that the city has enjoyed over the last several years. The district attorney's office, particularly through this program, is responsible for helping with these reductions by eliminating some of the crime anchors in a community, the areas or buildings or establishments that are at the root of a lot of the crime that is being committed in the neighborhoods of the city of New Orleans. So when these members of the Carrollton Riverbend Association met with the DA's office, they laid out for them everything that they've been going through for years. The district attorney's office began to investigate this. They determined who the owners of these properties were and said the owner of the property had created a number of LLCs that were holding the property. And the district attorney's office documented all that. The district attorney's office, once they determined who the owners were and confirmed that there was a problem, they went to the city agencies and asked them to administratively investigate and determine if those properties were in fact blighted. And through the hearing process, the city of New Orleans determined and declared that four different properties were in fact blighted. And the owner of those properties, I'm told, failed to respond to the opportunities to remediate those problems. And only after a year and a half of notifications and processes that through the administrative process that were engaged, if at any point in time, Mr. Morris, the person that was ultimately indicted, had stepped in to effectuate some of the repairs and comply with city code requirements and begin to fix some of the issues with his properties, he never would have been indicted. So this is an extreme case that this law was created to address, and this is the first time that this law has been applied in this manner. And the people that I've spoken to, a representative of the Carrollton Riverbend Neighborhood Association, and they expressed to me, you know, their frustration in this process. They informed me that members of the association ultimately through the years had decided to sell their property and move out of the city, move out of those neighborhoods just because of the blight and the problems. One of the 10 inmates that escaped was actually found hiding in one of the abandoned properties in this. So not only, you know, was the inmate using this as a hideout to, you know, after he escaped from the jail, but the residents have reported prostitution, drug activity, and firearm sales from these properties as well. And that not only affects the safety of the people that live in those neighborhoods, but the economic investment that they've maintained in their properties. And many of the people, because this took so long, you know, have given up, sold their property, moved out, which erodes the tax base. But the people that remained, they ultimately found the district attorney's office, and the district attorney's office navigated this first of its kind case through the administrative process, and only after the property owner was given ample opportunity to address the problems that had been identified and he failed to do so, did they indict him on these charges. And the penalty for this is up to 50 years in jail.
Wow.
So, you know, this is a significant penalty because this is a racketeering charge that's being brought. So, you know, I thought that this was worthy of talking about because, you know, in the area of these derelict, blighted properties, you're looking at dozens of crimes of violence over the last several years that have occurred in and around this area. And these blighted houses and properties were a byproduct or caused and contributed to the crime problems that have plagued this neighborhood since these properties became blighted and neglected.
Well, the blighted housing problem in this city is one that, going all the way back to Katrina, now 20 years in the coming days, and we really still haven't appropriately addressed it in the city, and it continues to be a problem. And hopefully at some point they'll ultimately get it resolved and you know, deal with this issue. Because it's
well, now there's a consequence. Before, the worst thing that could happen would be somebody might be fined, but who's going to somebody ain't going to necessarily worry about a crime. Now you can be fined. Now you can be charged with a crime, and a crime that actually has some serious penalties involved in it. The last thing that the district attorney's office or the state of Louisiana wants is to have to prosecute a property owner for not maintaining their property. But there has to be a consequence for people that are refusing to do and maintain their properties. And as I said, the standards to apply this law are extremely high. And this is going to be, a rarity. It's going to be an outlier. But what this does do, it sends a message to everybody else that, if you don't maintain your properties, if you ignore the administrative process, there could be a consequence for this. And this neighborhood has been suffering for over 5 years, and now they've finally found, some relief and some hope in all of this. So, if the property owner doesn't address this issue, then I believe the city probably has the authority to either seize or tear down these properties now, and the neighborhood can begin to reclaim, the quality of life that they deserve. And this would not have happened without the district attorney's office, particularly the no-dice program that they've successfully operated now for going on 2+ years.
Absolutely, and they deserve credit for engaging in this case for sure. I wanted to cover something real quick. We have just a couple of moments before we get to break, and that is the announcement by former Judge Darrell Derbigny of his retirement from the bench. I think in large measure had a lot to do with the reporting that you did on this particular case. An extraordinary remediation process by the Louisiana Supreme Court, not one, but two temporary judges assigned to this court, and a sharing of cases between the Louisiana Attorney General Liz Murrell's office and Jason Williams' office in order to try and expedite this docket to get it back to the court average here in short order. Your thoughts?
Well, so I was on your show back in April talking about the findings of our report that we released in August. In fact, we broke that on your show. And I spent a great deal of time talking about Judge Derbigny's section of court. So, when he had 412 plus open cases, and the court average was about 230 cases. The judge that had the fewest cases had 112 open cases. We looked at 51% of his cases were over a year old, and it was taking him twice as long than the court average to close a case. Shortly after we released that information, we were contacted by officials from the Louisiana Supreme Court, and we provided them with the data that we based our findings on. I found out subsequently that some officials from the Supreme Court paid a visit to Judge Derbigny a few days after our report was issued. And shortly after that visit, he elected to seek a medical leave. And when he left the bench, an ad hoc was appointed. And then a second ad hoc will be added to preside over the massive docket in Section J. But if we hadn't issued that report, Judge Durbiny's 412 open cases, he was not going to run for re-election, but he would not have come up for re-election until next fall.
Yep.
So it would have been 2027 before the next judge stepped into Section J. Those 400 cases were likely to be 600 to 700 open cases because Judge Durbiny stopped caring and stopped working.
Let us get to a break so we can talk about our last topic about your awards launching, because I do want to get that in today. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, I don't know if you had anything else to offer up on the Durbiny matter that we were talking about.
So, you know, just briefly, you know, the fact that the Supreme Court took note of our report, stepped in, he's gone. The docket is beginning to move. There's a plan to handle that docket. The docket is being split up between the DA's office and the Attorney General. The Attorney General's office is a great resource to the city of New Orleans and to prosecutions, just as the state police is to policing the city, their partnership with the police department. So the system is better off without Judge Durbiny, and to his credit, he did the right thing by retiring. He can collect his pension, and we can go about setting, you know, beginning to administer justice in Section J that's been neglected for way too long.
Absolutely. And hopefully the Louisiana Supreme Court puts something in place to monitor this. I mean, who knows what Judge Durbiny was doing all the while that he was sick. But on, let's pivot to your awards luncheon, the Metropolitan Crime Commission Excellence in Law Enforcement Awards Luncheon will be September the 24th from noon to 1:30 at Sheraton, New Orleans. Tell us about it.
So this is, you know, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. This is our annual fundraiser. And, you know, you've been, you know, good enough to support this through many years, both as sheriff and in your capacity with the media. So what we do is that we usually assemble an all-star lineup of guest speakers, but most importantly, we give out awards to well-deserving people in the law enforcement community. And the people that we like to single out are the unsung heroes that have worked on significant cases that resulted in arrest and convictions. So when we acknowledge, we're not just acknowledging the prosecutors or just the agency that made the arrest, but both together, because it is teamwork, and a prosecution is only as strong as the investigation. And many of these cases, I think, epitomize the fine work that's done by law enforcement from throughout this region. So this year we're going to be acknowledging the FBI and the United States Attorney's Office and some of the other investigative agencies that assisted in the investigation and successful prosecution of the Bird Gang. This is a gang that has been operating, you know, for years, and the federal government adopted this case, charged these individuals with racketeering, and obtained convictions of 10 of these gang members. So we're talking about the fact that crime has gone down over the last couple of years, in large part because violent and repeat offenders are being removed from the streets. That's exactly what this gang was. They actually went to trial and convicted several of the individuals that didn't plead guilty in this. There's been a total of 10 convictions. They've been linked to multiple murders, multiple other attempted murders, and a whole litany of offenses, including weapons and drugs. So this this gang has been dismantled. And we're going to acknowledge the investigators and the prosecutors that assisted in that. We're also going to be acknowledging the Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office and the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office for their successful prosecution of an individual that was involved in three murders and three attempted murders. And the thing that's going to be really interesting about all this is that we just don't give these individuals the award. We explain to the attendees the detail that the investigators did that assisted the prosecutors in presenting compelling evidence that convinced a jury to find someone guilty. And this person, is now going to be serving a life sentence. He was convicted of three counts of murder and three counts of attempted murder.
I got to move on. Yeah. We got a hard break coming up.
Gotcha.
And then I think the last one is the agencies involved in the response and investigation of the January 1st terror attack. There we go.
Please then, join us if you can.
And then Ann Kirkpatrick has committed to be one of the guest speakers again this year. People always enjoy hearing from her as well. September 24, 2025, noon to 1:30 at Sheraton, New Orleans. If you go to the MCC website, you can purchase tickets there. As always, we appreciate the time, the insight, and the incredible work that your organization does. Rafi Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Check in with Ian Hoke, who's in for Scoop. Ian Hoke in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Hey, good afternoon, Newell. We're going to talk a little bit about the U.S. Agency for International Development. Ain't there no more. And we're going to talk to somebody who used to work there about what that means for water and sanitation projects all over the globe. In the 3 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to David Muth about how the governor has canceled that $3 billion coastline restoration project, citing cost overruns and environmental concerns. We'll hear from somebody on the inside about the battle between politics and science and what it means for the future of Louisiana.
All righty. Ian Hoke is headed your way, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Thursday evening.